smoking. Our group is welcome to use this room and the restrooms that are across the hall and up a flight of stairs. So here we are this morning. This morning we're going to start off with Trust God, and we're going to be starting with Bob, and then we'll take a break at 10:15, come back at 10:30, and clean house with Bob and Valerie, and then we'll have a potluck lunch. We'll break around 11:45 and serve lunch at noon. So if y'all will help me welcome Bob this morning.
My name is Bob Darrell, and I am alcoholic.
Hey, Bob.
Well, I can't wait to hear what I'm going to say. I couldn't trust God. I'm not wired that way. I think I took little flyers at trusting you first. And you guided me into some actions that would eventually start to bring God into my life. And as a result of taking more actions, I started to realize that whatever this power was seemed to be on my side. And, you know, there's in the 12 steps and 12 traditions, it talks about the importance of hitting bottom. And it says that because until we get to that place, whatever that is, and it's a hard thing to define because it doesn't seem to exist in the material world. It seems to be inside. That place where you throw in your cards. That place where you're willing to do things you would never, ever do before. Even no matter how scary these actions are, that you're just desperate enough to take them. And, you know, in 1978, I got to a place my sponsor refers to as the place of no friendly direction. And that is the place where there's nowhere to go. There's no relief anywhere, and there's no hope of relief because you start to understand a bitter, bitter, bitter truth that's making you suicidal. And that is that alcohol and drugs doesn't do what it used to do, and it never will again. And you can't imagine life without it either, because you're no good without it. And now you're no good with it. It's a bad spot. It's a hopeless spot where there's no friendly direction. There's no relief anywhere. And consequently, guys like me, we try to kill ourselves at that point because we can't imagine life without it. And we can't imagine life with it, not the way it had become at the end. It was so horrible. And I ended up, as a result of this, after this failed suicide attempt, I ended up in a detox 2,000 miles away in Las Vegas, Nevada. I wasn't trying to go to Vegas. I didn't intend to get sober in Vegas. As a matter of fact, in Pennsylvania, if you would have said make a list of 100 cities you might get sober in one day, I'm telling you, Vegas would not have been on the list. But we are brought together by divine appointment. And I was exactly where I was supposed to be. And I ended up in this detox, and I got a sponsor, as I mentioned last night, and I started doing the things he suggested. And there was a woman who worked in that detox. Her name was Harris, and she was my counselor. And because she was my counselor in that 30-day program or whatever, however long it was, she had done a complete history on me, and she knew about all the treatment centers I had been in on the East Coast. She knew about all the therapy. She knew about all my attempts to get sober and my failures and my relapses. She knew it all. She knew about the meds I'd tried. She knew I'd worked as a counselor. She knew everything. And she was also a member of AA and a member of intermittent member of my first home group. And I was about 3 months sober, and I run into her at the Friday night meeting of my home group. And she comes up to me, and she's got this weird look on her face, and she says to me, she says, "Bob, what happened to you?" I don't know what she means. I said, "What are you talking about?" She says, "What happened to you?" I said, I don't know what you're talking about. She said, look, I hear that you became a secretary of a meeting. And I said, you know, I did. I'm not sober. You're supposed to be 6 months sober, but they voted me in anyway. Yeah. She said, every time I'm leaving the detox, you're one of the guys bringing, seems like you're one of the guys bringing the meetings in there. I said, yeah, I go in there with a bunch of guys a couple times a week. She said, I heard you signed up for the meeting at the state penitentiary. And I did. I didn't want to. I didn't think I had enough tattoos, but I did. I did. She said, I hear you got Dick T as a sponsor. And I said, yeah, I did. She says, are you calling him? I said, yeah, every day. She said, he's a good man. She said, I heard you're praying. And I got a little embarrassed. I said, well, I don't know if I believe in God. I'm saying this stuff they're telling me to say. She said, what happened to you? Because you never did all that stuff before. And I thought, wow, that's right. I had been relapsing in Alcoholics Anonymous for over 6 years. And I never did all those actions. They had me making amends. I tried to turn myself into the courts in Pennsylvania and offer to do 2 years in prison. I mean, I never did. All I ever did in my years around Alcoholics Anonymous was just take up a seat, drink the coffee, eat your donuts, hit on your women, and judge you properly. But I never took actions in AA. I never did anything. And I was thinking about it. I thought, wow, how come? What? Because there's an illusion that some of us unconsciously suffer from, and the illusion is that you'll hit this horrid, awful enough bottom that will catapult you into the actions in AA. And that was not the case. My last drunk was not the worst one I've ever been on. I'd had some earlier that were horrific. And I thought, well, what happened? And you know, when you're a homeless guy and you come off the streets and you ask for help in AA, AA is a funny place. If you ask for help here, the help comes, and it comes in bunches. It's overwhelming because we just live to help each other. But at the same time, if you come around AA and you exhibit through your body language and your demeanor of an aura of leave me alone, and you put that out, leave me alone, we'll leave you alone. I mean, there's always one guy somewhere that's off his meds that won't leave you alone, but for the most part, we leave you alone. Because we respect that. We're funny people because we respect your right to think we're full of crap, because at one time we all thought we were all the rest of you were full of crap. So we're good with that. But you open the door and the help comes, and it came, and people were coming out of the woodwork, giving me rides to meetings and buying me lunch, because I had nothing. And I'm at a noon meeting one day, and this guy Tim comes up to me and he says, you can help me out. I want you to do me a favor. I said, yeah, what? And he takes me out to his car and he opens a trunk. And he's got these really nice sport coats and dress shirts. And they're all just came from the, and slacks. They've all just came from the dry cleaners. And they're cleaned and pressed and all, I mean, they're nice stuff. And he says to me, which I found out later was a bunch of BS. He says to me, my wife is really on my back to get rid of this stuff and make some closet space. You could be really helping me out if you take this off my hands. And he was so brilliant because he knew that even though I had nothing and I was destitute, that if he would have tried to give me charity, my pride would have rose up. And I'd have said, I don't need your help. I would have done that probably. But there are people in Alcoholics Anonymous, by their own experience, they know how to love the unlovable and give to the unreceivable. And he knew how to help me. And I said, well, yeah, you put it that way, I'll help. If I would have been on my A game, I would have asked him if she had a car he wanted to get rid of. But he gave me all these clothes, and there in the corner of the trunk of the car was a box of novels. And he said, I've already read all these. Would you like to read them? And I loved it. I'm a readaholic. I to this day read a couple books a week. And I looked at the titles, and they were, it was not recovery stuff. It was all fiction. It was like kind of kill time novels, interesting stuff, some science fiction, some regular fiction, mystery or two. I said, yeah, man, I'd love to read that stuff. And I took all that stuff back to what place I was staying. And I started to read this book out of the box he gave me. And it was just a novel, and there was an interesting segment in the novel where they were talking about these scientists that were doing experiments on the human brain. And they discovered in the human brain was a part that they referred to, had a Latin name, but they kept referring to it in the book as the pleasure center of the brain. And it's the part of the brain that allows you to experience the euphoria from alcohol, cocaine, heroin. It's where you get high. It's without it, you can't get high. So these scientists took these laboratory rats and they put two tiny wire filaments into the pleasure center of the rat's brain, and they would pass an electric stimulus through those wires and it would stimulate the pleasure center and the rat would get high. So what they did is they hooked up the juice to a pedal in the rat's cage and the rat would learn it could hit that pedal and get high. So the rat just lays on the damn pedal. I mean, he don't stop to eat or drink or sleep. I mean, you can pray rats in the opposite sex and heat by him, and he'll go, not now, baby, I'm partying. He just keep hitting that pedal. He hit that pedal until he died. Usually, his heart would seize up from dehydration and exhaustion. He died. Well, scientists said, oh my God, these rats are dying. So they started putting monitors on the rats to see when they were in danger of dying. And then when they got to that point where they were in danger, they turned the juice off. Well, they turned the juice off, and this poor rat who'd been partying and hitting the pedal, now he hits the pedal and nothing happens. And he hits it again and nothing happens, and again and again. And after countless futile attempts to turn the juice back on, the rat finally gets it, that it's done. And instead of being able to go back to just being a rat, the rat would curl up in a ball and lay on the floor of the cage to die. Because without the juice, what's the point? And I'm reading that and I'm going, oh my God, that's what happened to me. It wasn't the consequences and the trouble and the problems that occurred from my drinking that broke me. What really broke me is that there was, I get it, I'm like that rat. They turned, I can't get high like I got high when I was 20 years old anymore. They turned the juice off. And that's really what I wanted. I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous really, I don't think, to get sober. I came here because of the membership requirement in the original third tradition, when it says membership should include all who suffer from alcoholism. I didn't have a desire not to drink, truly. And I discovered over the years through taking the actions of Alcoholics Anonymous that AA is not designed to get you to quit drinking at all. Matter of fact, if it was, there'd be a chapter into quitting or something. You know what I mean? There'd be a part, they'd probably be in big letters on some page and say, Bob, better stop, cut it out, stop. And in actuality, it says the opposite. It says you can't, can you? It says there's going to come a time when you have no mental defense against the first drink. It says things like lack of power is your dilemma, Bob. You can't stop, can you? You are powerless. Even though you know it's going to kill you and you're going to die a mad dog, horrible death, you don't have the power, no matter how much you make up your mind, to stop yourself from going back and relapsing yourself to death. You get 6 months here, you get 3 months there, you get 8 months there. Maybe you get a year once in a while, but you're going to relapse yourself to death. And it's not a fun way to go. But Alcoholics Anonymous isn't designed to do that at all. AA is designed to do one thing and one thing only. It's designed to turn the juice back on. It's designed slowly and incrementally to create a transformation on the inside that lights me up and sets me free the same way five shots of tequila did when it was magic. When all of a sudden I get a depressed guy who doesn't fit anywhere, who can't even talk to girls or guys or nothing, could have four or five drinks and I could come out and play and get free. And what was that? Wouldn't it be fair to say that when alcohol was magical and when it worked at its very best, what did it do? I'll tell you what I think it did. I think it relieved me of the bondage of self. I can walk into a bar or a party and I'm locked up, stuck up inside of me. And I just look out at the world as if in this state of separation, like it's all of you having fun and then there's me. And four or five drinks and whatever had me locked up inside of me, it would go away and I could come out and play and I could get free. It would get me right up off of me and set me free. And Alcoholics Anonymous is designed to do the same thing. It's designed to relieve me of the bondage of self. There is only one freedom, and within it, it contains all freedoms. And that is the freedom from the bondage of self. There's a supermax penitentiary mid-California coast up in Morro Bay, and I've gone up there to do a couple talks from time to time. And there's an amazing AA group there. And these guys, for the most part, are lifers. There's a lot of these guys, they're never getting out of prison. There's no parole for them, nothing. And they found Alcoholics Anonymous, and they found the steps in prison, and they have created the most amazing AA group. There's a line of greeters, 10, 15 people, and they're all delighted you're there. They got people doing service. They do their own institution work. They've got to deal with the warden. When new fish come into the fish tank, they take a couple guys and they go down there and they read the guy, the doctor's opinion, to see if he's one of us. They do 12-step. They do institution work inside the institution. I think that's very cool. And I'm watching some of these old-timers who are lifers. They're never going to get out of prison. And I'm watching them laugh, and I'm watching them talk to the people they sponsor in there, and I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, ain't that something? These guys are legitimately more free doing life in prison than guys I sit in meetings with on the outside that look depressed and mopey all the time. They're always whining and complaining about crap. Because there is only one freedom, and they found it even in a max, super max penitentiary that they'll never get out of. They found the freedom from the bondage of self. And that's why I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's why I continue to work these steps and I continue to help others. It's the deal. But I don't come to God easily. I'm afraid of God, and I'm afraid of everything. And a guy is so... You know, 6 years, over 6 years of relapsing. I tried everything in those 6 years. Every medication. I've switched from alcohol to speed to heroin to methadone to Dilaudid to pills to back to alcohol to combinations of alcohol and anything I could get my hands on. And I mean, if it had a shot at giving me relief, I took a run at it. You know what I'm saying? I just done that guy. And it all failed. It all failed. And here I am in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm desperate, and I'm scared, and I don't want to relapse anymore because I know something. I don't know a lot, but I know that if this disease is true to form in its progressive nature, which means that every time I try to get sober again, I'm a little bit worse than I was the last time. That means that the next time that little bit that was missing that pushes me over the edge, and I will actually jump from the bridge instead of breaking down sobbing as a coward at the last minute. I knew that there's no more chances for me. And I'm scared. And I go to a meeting. And I was only a couple days out of detox. And I'm living in this halfway house. And I walk down to this Awano Club. And I go to this meeting. And there's a guy in there named Joe Wright. And Joe was pretty influential in my early sobriety. I like Joe. Joe was a hard street guy. Joe had murdered a couple people, and he was trying to make amends by helping others. And he struggled. But he was a good member of AA, and he worked these steps. He was a pretty good guy. Joe cornered me after a meeting one time, and I'm pretty new. I'm only about a week out of detox. I'd shared in the meeting, which is I don't share much because I'm afraid of sharing in meetings, and I stumbled through a few sentences and passed. And Joe came up to me after the meeting, and he said, he heard something I said set him off. And he said to me, he said, you need to take step three. And you know, I'm in the Alano Club, they got the steps on the wall, the traditions. I look at step three, and I said to Joe, I can't do step three. He said, why not? Well, truth is, Joe, I don't believe in God. I don't know if there's a God or not. I don't have that. And Joe said, you don't have to believe in God to take step three. I said, well, Joe, I mean, that kind of says that. I mean, step two came to believe. Step three made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. I don't understand God. I don't even believe in God. I can't do it. He said, listen to me, kid. You don't have to believe in God to do step three. And I'm looking at him, I guess, like I don't believe him. And he said, I'll tell you what. If you'll turn your will and your life over to this chair, and he points to a chair in the Alano Club, I guarantee you an instant miracle. So I thought, what the hell? All right, Joe, I turn my will and life over to this chair. And he said, he gets a big smile. I said, well, the miracle is your life's no longer in the hands of an idiot. And I didn't get mad. I didn't get defensive. I just stood there and thought, yeah, that'd be right. And I started to move towards God and trusting God, not because I'm moving to trust God. I'm mistrusting me. I'm starting to get the truth. I'm starting to see objectively the big picture here. It's not that I trust God. I just can't. I gotta stop trusting me. I mean, for God's sakes, I get it. Because if you would have followed me around the last couple years, and maybe as people have observed you, your family, your friends, your loved ones, for God's sakes, could anyone come to any conclusion watching a guy like me other than, whoever's making decisions for Bob must be out to kill him. Yet when you have a rationalizing, a defending mind that explains everything and chatters to you, tells yourself little stories that makes it all nice, you don't see the picture. Because alcoholics are disassociated from their own reality. We don't live in our lives. We live in the story of our lives between our ears. We don't even live our lives. I'm disassociated and disconnected from life itself. Because I am self, my consciousness is centered on me. It's self-centered and self-ish. The book says that is the root of our troubles. It really is. That's why I drink again. Is that I get sober and I just get myself right on me, like that creature in that movie Alien that attaches itself to your face. And I'm so obsessively focused on my feelings and what you think of me and my future and my horrible, shameful past. And it's all just right on me. And I live up in here, disconnected from life itself, looking at life and everybody else as if they're so far away, with a feeling like it's all of you, and then there's me. separate and apart from life itself. Alcohol, one of the first things I ever heard in AA that I connected with is I heard a man talking about every time he quit drinking, he would have this feeling that he didn't fit. And I thought, yeah, what's that about? Well, in the old days, when I would drink, I fit, man. I could be one of the guys. I was connected. But I get sober, and I'm just so... It was almost as if some invisible yet impenetrable barrier would come up between me and life itself. And the reason that I don't feel like I fit out here in the world with all of you is the truth is I don't live out here in the world with all of you. I live up here in this world with all of me. Disassociated, disconnected from life itself because my center of my consciousness is on me. And I'm in its bondage. And I can't wish it away. I remember being in a meeting. And I was sitting, you're going to one of those discussion meetings where they go around the room, right? Well, in a meeting like that, if you're like me, if it's on the other side of the room, you don't really have to pay attention. You can do what you like to do the most. You can daydream about you. You know, you can have three or four relationships, kids, a marriage, put the kids through college. You can make $1 million. You can do all that kind of stuff just as it's going around the room. Well, when it starts getting a little closer, you have to start paying attention because you're eventually going to share. And so now you got to get in the game, and now you got to pay attention. It's starting to come around, and I got to pay a little attention. And this woman, she says something I'd never heard before. She says, yeah, I was self-centered. I went through life totally self-absorbed. And when she said that, it hit me because I'm sitting there thinking about what I'm going to share when it gets to me. What you're going to think of what I'm going to share. I'm even changing the way I'm sitting because I'm trying to find that way to sit where I look humble yet authoritarian at the same time. It's a hat trick. I mean, you got to, I don't want to look too uptight. I don't want to look too relaxed. I'm just swerving around just trying to get that right balance so I look like I know what I'm talking about and I get humble at the same time. You know, and so when she says self-absorbed, I'm seeing that, oh my God, I'm totally absorbed in myself. And it was like this veil lifted. I thought, oh my God, that's what they mean when they say selfishness, self-centeredness is the root of our trouble. That's what they're talking about. And it had ripple effects through my whole life. And it was funny how I'd been this way all my life and yet couldn't see it until that moment. And couldn't see it. And all of a sudden I understood why I have problems in my life with people, because it's all about me. Why I'm separate and apart from. Why I'm the guy that they're always letting go at jobs. Where if I'm working somewhere and there's 20 people there and they're all going somewhere together, I'm the guy they forget to ask to go. Right? I'm the guy that, I don't know why, but people seem at work to walk on eggshells around me. And they're just a little like this. And I started realizing that's because I'm all like this. Because I'm all up here. And it feels like rejection to others. Isn't it odd that the fear, the insecurity that drives you into your head and separates you from others is often misinterpreted by others as arrogance. You think you're better than the rest of us. And inside you're going, oh no, I feel so inadequate. I feel so less than. And yet my defense mechanisms to my inadequacy make me appear in such a way that people walk away from me as if I really am inadequate or if there really is something wrong with me. And I can't see me the way you see me. I'm asleep. One of the great promises of Alcoholics Anonymous is in step 12. that we're going to wake up. We're going to have a spiritual awakening as the result. And I think 90% of all spiritual awakenings is you just pull your head out of your butt and you get to see what everybody else has been seeing all along. I mean, most of us come to AA and we feel like victims. We don't know what, how come everyone's turned on me? How come I lost all these jobs? How come she left me? How come my parents let me do it? You know, we're depressive mopes and victims. And then you do step four and it's like the veils lift and you go, now I know why they left me. Because you're looking at it through their eyes. You're seeing what they saw. It's not a mystery anymore. You get it. You get it. And so I started to, I got together with my sponsor towards the end of my first year, and I did the third step prayer on page 63. After reading this part of the book over and over again for quite some time, I'm not alone in this because I've talked to a lot of people, but there's something, my ego is so resistant to change that it will not allow me to see the obvious that everyone else has seen in me for years, and it seems like I'm the last one to know. And then when you know, you feel like an idiot. You thought, oh my God, that's been going on for years. How come I never saw that before? It's like some of us, you finally realize you're self-centered, and at the moment of the awakening, where you go, oh my God, I'm so sick. And you say, well, how long have you been that way? At least an hour. No, it's not. You've been that way all your life. And there's a line in here that I love. It says that we are extreme examples of self will run riot. And then it says, no, we usually don't think so. They're not saying, hey, you know, occasionally, you have a little bit of a problem with self-will. Now, they're not saying, they're saying, you're off the frickin' charts, man. Here's the worst of humanity when it comes to self-centeredness. And see that speck up in the stratosphere? That's you. You're an extreme example. And then it says, though you usually don't think so, do you? You ever been in the middle of a self-will binge and think to yourself, this is really self-will? No, you're right. You're right. When you're right, you don't think you're wrong. The ego has an inability to see that it's wrong. My ego, this thing that I'm in the bondage of, I don't think it cares if it kills me, as long as after I'm dead, everybody walks around and goes, well, yeah, but Bob was right. I mean, he was right. Egocentric, as people like to call it nowadays. I'm in its bondage. And I did what a lot of us do after reading this. I said that third step prayer. And there's a delusion in here that I think cuts to the core of your discomfort, conflict, and problems in relationships sober. And you probably can't see it. And it says that we are victims, and we really are. I mean, I went to a meeting one time, and the subject was how we're not victims anymore. I said, yeah, you know something? I'm a victim sometimes. And the guy, victim? Yeah, I'm a victim of a delusion that I can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if I only manage well. If I just was properly financed. If I just had the right people loving me the right way, not like those others, but the right people loving me the right way. If I had the right job with the right amount of respect. If I lived in the right house in the right neighborhood. If I had all my ducks lined up in a row, surely then I will have wrested some satisfaction and some happiness out of this world. The reason that this is a delusion is that if you were to step back from us as a demographic and look at just people that have this spirituality like we do, I don't think you'll find a demographic on the planet that has ever spent more money, more energy, more obsessive focus and time on trying to make themselves happy and satisfied as we have. And the end result is, would you sponsor me? Right? I mean, you get that? You get that? That's why that's a delusion? That's why guys, alcoholics with 15 years sober in $10 million houses on the beach in California put a pistol to their head and blow their brains out, and they have absolute everything out here, but nothing in here. And those of us that have gone that route, we know a painful truth that no matter how good you get it out here, if it ain't no good in here, it ain't no good. And so it's a delusion, and it drives guys like me. And I got down on my knees with this guy, and I said the third step prayer. I didn't think I understood what I was saying. I even though I read this, I don't think I really understood it. Today I look back, and I'm sure I didn't. But what I'm saying in the prayer is, I say, God, I offer myself to you, for you, not me, for you to build with me and for you to do with me as you will. What about my will? No more, Bob. You've had a nice run with that. That's not worked out very well for you, has it, Bob? No, that's okay. So I'm trying to make my life none of my business. And I can't. How does a mind that's obsessed with itself stop doing that? Because I'm in the bondage of self. And so I'm imploring God to relieve me of the bondage of self. Because I can't wish it away. I can't wish away this obsessive self-involvement and self-concern and worry. I can't. The knowledge that I'm that way does not change it. Matter of fact, if there's a hell on earth, it's knowing how screwed up you are and the absolute lack of power to change yourself. So what do? You just go around beating yourself up all the time for being imperfect. Lack of power is my dilemma. I know I'm self-centered. I know I'm selfish, and I can't stop. So I'm asking God to relieve me of the bondage of self. And if he'll do that, if he'll take away these difficulties with self, that I will start inventorying for the rest of my life in the selfishness and self-seeking, dishonesty, fear, resentments. If he'll take away these difficulties with self, do it so that victory over them would bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. See, it's not about you anymore. It's about your ability to be a servant. You've served yourself for all these years. How's that worked? Has that worked out good for you? So I'm going to stop serving myself and start to serve God. The only way to serve God is to serve his kids. And so to help others. So this is really a decision to head my life in the direction of self-abandonment and service. Why? Because I'm a noble, altruistic guy? No, because the wheels have come off in my life. I'm going to die here. I'm going to die on good intentions and dying. I'm going to kill myself trying to make myself happy. I'm going to die. And so I make this decision. I say that prayer. And then I went through a period of a couple years, because the book says on the bottom of page 63, the top of 64, that next we set out a course of vigorous action, which in my case was about 3.5 years later. And it's not that I didn't go right after the third step into a fourth step. I did, but there was no, I had no understanding, and there was no one in Alcoholics Anonymous in the 1970s in my community that understood this book. As a matter of fact, I don't even think there was an old timer in the city of Las Vegas that could even tell you what part of the big book the fourth step was in. It was a universal thing that if you'd ask an old guy in AA, how do I do a four-step, he'd send you to a step study where they studied the steps out of a series of essays written about the steps in a book called The 12 Steps and 12 Traditions. And so I did my first four-step when I was a little over a year sober. I did 40 pages. Honest, it was honest. But there was no change in perception. There was nothing in it. I did the second one, answering the 30-some questions in chapter 4 of the book, The 12 Steps and 12 Traditions, and writing most of a page of the on each of the seven deadly sins. And nothing had changed. Nothing happened. I'm still stuck in being me. There is no transformation. There is no different looking at the world. There's no change in perception. There's nothing. I'm still me. I'm still fighting with depression. I'm still feeling like I don't quite fit. I'm going through jobs at a rapid pace. My first 4 years of sobriety, I went through 9 jobs. That speaks volumes of untreated alcoholism and a sick spirit right there. Every place I ever worked, they were doing it wrong. And I was the guy that was leaving. Some of those places are doing it successfully 30-some years later. They're doing it wrong, but they're doing it successfully. And so what happened to me is I got, for the next couple years, every single morning, I would get down on my knees and I would say the third step prayer. And I'd get up off my knees and I was blocked because I have the intention of turning my will and my life over to the care of God, but I haven't done the work to reduce me enough to carry that out. And that's, the book says that. It says that unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things that are blocking me. You know what untreated alcoholism in sobriety feels like to me? It feels like I'm stuck. I know I need to be different, and I can't. I feel stuck. It's like I can see the promised land, I just can't get there. And I'm lost in the abyss between who I need and want to be and who I actually am. Because I haven't done the rest of the work. And that is a journey in itself. But before we go on anymore, I'm going to turn it over to Valerie to talk a little more about whatever she feels like talking about.
Trusting God, can I do that? I did it. Trusting God, I like most alcoholics, didn't trust God. I was afraid of God too. I was afraid of what God was going to ask me to do. And, you know, first blush is God is going to ask me to go be a nun in South America and never have sex or money again in my life. That's what it got. It's going to be bad. Some kind of punishment. And I'm not going to be happy. What is that noise? I did not do it.
It's David thinking.
It's David thinking. That was awesome.
I don't know how to fix it.
I mean, can y'all hear it, or is it just
me? Yeah, I can hear it.
So anyway, so, and I expressed those concerns to my sponsor, and similar to, you know, what good sponsorship says, you know, well, if that is what happens, that's certainly a lot better than what you've got going on right now, which was true. I had completely leveled my life sober. I had nothing good going on sober. I lost everything, the little that I had regained, sober. So it would have been a lot better than what I had come up to. For me, every time my jump to trusting God and that experience of trusting God has grown, has been on the heels of catastrophe. And, you know, when I first came in, when I first came crawling back into Alcoholics Anonymous, and every time since then, every time I've run up against self in sobriety, I've been faced with that same question. Well, is God everything or is he nothing? And I want God to be everything, but I also want God to respect my plan and at least give it a good listen. You know, when I was new and going through this stuff and going through We Agnostics, you know, and I, afraid of God, didn't trust God, didn't understand God, didn't know how to rely on God, any of that stuff, you know, when God was that flimsy reed, you know, I really identify with him in We Agnostics, where it talks about, you know, friendly hands stretched out and welcome. You got to step from bridge to shore, and here's all those really super spiritual people that I hate in AA going, trust God, Val, it's going to be okay. And I want to kill them. I'm like, explain that to me. How? How is that going to be okay? Well, just surrender it. Just turn it over. I mean, I'm like, I'm going to fucking kill you. What do you mean? I didn't get that. I mean, there has to be something to do. To just trust God and everything's going to be okay did not seem like a message of depth and weight to me at all. And, you know, there's these people with these outstretched hands. So I really identify with not knowing how to do that, and the frustration and the despair, too. Of, oh my God, I hear you. I hear what you're telling me, and I can't do it. I don't know what you mean. Give me concrete little things that I got to do. Give me a guarantee. And the book does that. It does do it. It does give us all kinds of promises and guarantees if I will take the action without understanding what that's going to look like. And those were, and they were conscious decisions that I made. To trust Alcoholics Anonymous, to trust the big book, to trust what my sponsor was telling me. Because I had no experience with it being true. None. You know, the little rocket ship thing that they talk about in We Agnostics? About, you know, if you know, they hadn't explored the moon, but dudes had been flying, and they swore men would never fly, and because of that experience, if you ask somebody, are they going to go to the moon? You know, their mind had been opened a little bit, and they're like, sure, why not? But it hadn't happened yet. And, you know, they talk about if you show any longshoremen this idea. I can't remember exactly how they say it. But anyway, the point is, yeah, I believe it'll happen, although I don't know when. I don't know what that rocket's going to look like. I don't know how it's all going to come together, but I'm sure it will happen. And that was what was being asked of me, to just be willing to believe that, just be willing to trust God, even though you don't know what it's going to look like or what form it's going to take. And for someone who's so fearful, that's a very frightening proposition. With no experience that what you're saying is true. All I know is that I'm sober and I haven't been able to do that. You got me there. I haven't been able to pull off sobriety. on my own. So it was just those small steps for me, and those conscious, for me, they were conscious decisions to start trusting my Creator. I mean, I had been turning my back on my intuitive thought for years. I don't ever remember trusting it, ever, that voice within, because it never made sense. It never made sense to me. It's too much of a risk. And then I'm sober and forced into a corner. I mean, and I'm literally like a child stomping my feet, like, fine, I'll trust it, but you better be there, you know? I mean, I remember having that conversation with God. I hate you right now, but I'm going to trust this thing, this feeling, this idea that you've put within me, and I'm going to take some action. I mean, we should always check out our ideas with sponsorship, FYI. You know, I've had some great ideas. But anyway, you know, we should make sure they're sane. But it was actually a conscious decision for me when I stepped from bridge to shore and to trust that intuitive voice within and take action on that. Do you know I like a man on his knees? Is that going to make a difference? Are y'all recording this? You didn't tell me that. Y'all are recording this. So, anyway, so making that decision to trust my Creator. And trusting that it's a loving and kind Creator. You know, one of the things that it talks about here is that care our Creator, return our will and our life over to the care and the protection, and that those were very kind adjectives, words to describe what was going on. That I'm turning my, all this mess up here and in here and everything I hope to become, want to become, whatever, all my plans, everything I am, good and bad, and I'm both, trust me, that I'm putting all of that into my Creator's hands, the good and the bad, into my Creator's hands, His protection and care. And that those were nice words, nothing to be afraid of. I still was, but it started to lighten me up a little bit. It started to open me up and not be so, hold on so tight. I mean, my entire life has been fear-driven. I've made all kinds of decisions based on fear because I could not trust my God. That landed me in a jackpot every single time. Sometimes the jackpot was an immediate gift, and sometimes it's years down the road from that one thing of being afraid of my Creator, being unwilling to trust God within. And it definitely has been for me a journey of becoming I like how Bob talks about the spiritual life as a life of subtraction, of being subtracted from that has created a bigger space to trust that God, that power, whatever you want to call it, more and more and more. Or that's been my experience anyway. And I loved when he was talking about in the book where it talks about, you know, we're extreme examples of self-overrun riot. When I read that in the book, what was going through my head is, no, I'm not. And then I read, though they usually don't think so, and I'm like, damn. You know? I mean, that was what was going through my head. No, I'm not. I'm a nice person. Mm-hmm. you know, but some of the stuff that, that really helped me and gave me some hope that was in here that it's talking about, it was shocking to me that selfish and self-centeredness was the root of my troubles. I thought you were the root of my troubles. Really? I really did. I was horrified by that. And the being driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, self-pity, that I step on the toes of my fellows and they retaliate. That I set balls in motion out of my own fear or my desire to get mine so I can rest satisfaction and happiness out of this world. I mean, those were shocking revelations to me, that I was the problem. That it was never about you. I called my sponsor one time, and, you know, resentment du jour of the day, whatever. And I can't, so important, I can't remember what it was. And but, you know, at the time, it's earth-shattering and all-consuming. And I'll never forget my sponsor saying to me, my sponsor's from North Carolina now, "Well, Val, as far as I can tell, everybody's right, even when they're wrong." And I'm like, "What? No, that's not true." You know, but it makes me think too about the, it doesn't matter. All I can do is look at me and look at where I am wrong. You know, those little intrusions of self, the things that make me angry, unhappy, fearful, all those intrusions of self are the voice of a life that's not lived. You know, they are the thing that propel me to go look at myself and become honest with myself. And in that process, I get closer to my Creator. It's kind of weird. So, you know, I'm not asking for any resentments today, but if you want to piss me off, it would be great, because it will give me an opportunity to look at me. In a good way, not in a self-centered way. I mean, they're the voice of the part of me that's not alive, that's still asleep. Does that make sense? They're poking. It's never been about you. It never has been and never will be. And, you know, I love that when it talks about my problems are basically of my own making. I've done it. It's not you. And it never was. You know, and I'm sure we'll talk about it more when we get into inventory, but I am responsible for my recovery. I am responsible for the actions that I take here. The outcome is absolutely out of my hands. I can't make anything happen. I've got to be willing to trust that there's a merciful Creator, that if I suit up and show up, it's all taken care of. And I've had a lot of experience trying to make things happen. And sometimes it looks like I am making it happen. And I'm like excited. And I want more. And I'm going to get more. And then I'm back into that self-driven, I'm going to get mine. And I think I have done all of this. Look at me. Look at what I have done. When the reality is, man, I barely tied my shoe when I got here. You know, all I did was suit up and show up and start taking these actions, you know, in our home group and all the stuff that we're asked to do here. And then God, in this spiritual thing, this spiritual juju starts to intrude on me and in my life, that starts to change my life. But I start to take some of the credit for that. I made a lot of money this year. Look, I am awesome. Yeah? Look what I have done. But, you know, that's mainly on the inside. If I might say that to you, but the reality is, oh, look at what God's done for me. Mm-hmm. But on the inside is the, I just kick unholy ass. I'm so great. you know, that arrogance, that that self-centered arrogance of forgetting what has happened in my life and what I've been given and what God has done for me. And you can tie it all up with some nice lies. You can take spiritual truths I have found and manipulate them, twist them, and distort them to feed the ego, to feed the delusion. That idea that I am the master of my destiny. I am the one who's in charge. I am the one who's making things happen. No. No. So, I love this piece too, that tells me that there seems no way of entirely getting rid of myself without God's aid. I mean, it is what it is. I would love to be able to think myself into who I think I should be and poof my character defects at will, and when I want them to be gone, you know, when they're not serving me. But I can't. That I need God's help. And I've got to trust God with that as well. You know, I cannot manage my spiritual life. I cannot manage my spiritual experience. When I was younger in sobriety, I used to try to manufacture spiritual experiences for myself. You know, it didn't happen. But I tried real, real hard. Really, really hard to make them happen. So I could create what I thought I needed to be. You know, there was no to surrender to, okay, God, I'll do what you want me to do. I'll go where you want me to go. I'll be what you want me to be. You know, letting go all that, the good and the bad, surrendering both of those things. I don't know what it's going to look like. But I've had enough experience now where I know me running the show, drunk or sober, is not good. I mean, I wouldn't be up here talking about finding a relationship with God if I had been able to manage it myself. If that had worked. If I could run my own life successfully. I don't need this. I don't need to spend that time in prayer and meditation helping other people, writing the inventory. I mean, my God, we do a lot of stuff. Light a candle, pray, whatever. It's like it takes me an hour just to go out the door to be nice to somebody. You know what I'm saying? We got a lot of work to do, you know? So I can go be of service to God's kids. And I like to, you know, with my sponsor, I just have fond memories of this, you know, when it says, first of all, we had to quit playing God, you know. And I mean, my sponsor had to break it down for me. Well, Val, it says we got to quit. That must be mean that you've been playing God. If this book is asking you to quit doing it, you know, quit running your life. That God's going to be my director. And they, you know, have several examples of what that looks like. And that is the nature of the relationship. And it's a kind relationship. God's going to take care of it and tell you where to go and what you need to do. It'll be fuzzy sometimes. You won't be sure. But that's what sponsorship and talking to people that are on the path in AA will help you along. Coincidences will happen. You'll be led in certain directions. I mean, we hear about it all the time in AA. About impossible situations that happen here. Remarkable coincidences. People that come from complete despair, and they're completely transformed, and their life is transformed, and they're doing something they thought they would never be doing. Happier than they've ever been. You know, and like in We Agnostics says, well, God made these things possible, but we only smiled. That was me. I smiled. I had seen spiritual release, but I'll tell myself it's not true. It's true for you, but not for me. But when you're desperate, when you get desperate enough, you'll be like, all right, fine. I don't know what it's going to look like. Don't know what path it's going to take, but I'll do it. Fine. I don't have anywhere else to go. But trusting that relationship, that God's going to be directing me. That God's the Father, I'm His child, God's the director. I'm the little agent. I go about God's business. God, what would you have me do today? What would you have me be today? You know, when I was going through this with my sponsor, and we were reading this, and we're getting ready to do some praying, and it says, as we felt new power flow in, I'm like, I don't feel no new power. Where's my new power? I don't feel nothing. I don't feel anything. Because I want something, I want to feel it. You know, I like to live way up here or way down here. You know, my sponsor used to say, if it goes boom, I'm interested, you know. I like things that go boom. I like high, high highs and low, low lows. You know, the in-between stuff I'm not too interested in. So I'm like waiting for the bush, you know, the burning bush. And nothing was happening. So it's, I'm like, are you sure this crap's going to work, you know? But I, you know, like I shared with you last night, I mean, I looked at these promises of peace of mind, discovering that I could face life successfully. Face life successfully. Oh my God, that's huge. I'm afraid to live. And this is telling me, I'm afraid of life. And this is telling me that I'm going to be able to face life successfully. I mean, those were huge promises that I bet my life on. I was like, this stuff better be true. I'm going to do this crazy stuff that I don't understand, that I don't know what it's going to look like, how my life's going to turn out, where God's going to take me. You know, this stuff better be true. That I'll become conscious of God's presence, that I'll begin to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, the hereafter. And that is what's happened. Most of the time, I feel that way. It's almost like, you know, the fine line between serenity and not giving a shit. I mean, it's very tricky. It's like, whatever. I used to say to my sponsor, and it just made it simple for me, because I was looking for the spiritual woo-woo feeling to know, so I know that it's working, you know. And my sponsor just said to me, are you sober today? I'm like, what does this mean, this consciousness, presence? I mean, I think I'm going to, you know, feel the magic. And my sponsor just said, well, to me, the consciousness, being consciously aware of the presence of God, is being consciously aware that I am sober today. Because someone like me isn't sober today without God. Regardless of whether I'm mad at God or I have faith in God or whatever, the reality is God's doing something in my life today if I'm sober. Because that's not my natural state. And it made it really, really simple, something tangible for me. Until that internal step happened where I knew about this brotherhood stream. It was something that I could hold on to, being consciously aware that I'm sober today, and that's not something I can pull off. So when I did the third step prayer, you know, I was looking for an effect, you know. And the effect was I started writing inventory. which is not my normal desire. I was given some power to go write inventory. My belief is that once a third step prayer has been honestly made, you don't get to take that back. That has been my experience. I said yes to God a long time ago when I did that third step prayer honestly, to the best of my ability. I said yes. I said yes to a spiritual life, and I said yes to a life of service. That's what I chose when I took that prayer. And I haven't been able to get away from that since then. It's like God got his little, you know, God finger in there. And, you know, and I've been mad about it at different times. You know. But I've never been able to take that back. I've never been able to take it back. Doesn't mean I've never made mistakes or done crazy stuff. I have dishonest stuff. I have. I mean, you know, all that stuff that we can still do. But I've never been able to take it back. I've never been able to turn around and walk away. I've never not been able to not be, try to be of service to another human being or another alcoholic. And to me, that's been the real gift of step three, is that decision and how it's changed my life in ways that I had no idea. That's all been good. Not one bit of it's harmed me at all. So, I don't know if that we're done. Are we done? What time is it? We're done? Thanks.
Thank you, Valerie and Bob, for getting us off straight this morning. We're going to take a 15-minute break. Smokers, please use the butt cans outside and step away from the church doors. There'll be coffee out there for you guys, and we'll see you back at 10:30. Thanks.